The war in the Middle East escalates as it passes a somber milestone.
My worry is that it could be without end, right? That it's simply war in search of security that is itself elusive, because the things that are continuing insecurity for the people of the region are not being addressed.
Monster hurricanes fueled by climate change bring dire warning of what's to come.
It symbolizes something that could happen in the future and the danger of climate change, which is that you could have multiple events that have been made each more destructive by climate change affecting the same area.
It's all coming up on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hello, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. On Monday, October 7th, the one-year anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel was commemorated.
The October 7th attack scarred souls. And on this day, we remember all those who were brutally killed and suffered unspeakable violence, including sexual violence, as they were simply living their lives.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres marking the somber occasion, while also noting the year-long Israeli military campaign in Gaza that has left more than 42,000 Palestinians dead, millions displaced, and a catastrophic humanitarian crisis that continues to worsen.
And while its war on Hamas continues in Gaza, tensions rise with Iran as Israel expands military operations targeting Hezbollah in Lebanon. We spoke with John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace.
When you reflect on 1 year, could you have imagined the horror that the world has seen since then, after months of warnings from the U.S. and world leaders of a potential escalation of an all-out regional war? Could you ever imagined all of the things we've seen from then until now?
No, is the very short answer. I mean, the violence we saw on October 7th, I couldn't have imagined on October 6th. I was one of those people that's been warning for years that we're facing a catastrophe if we don't address the underlying issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I knew something would happen, but I don't think I was prepared for just the level of violence and dehumanization and horror. And I guess in retrospect, I should have understood that that was going to set the tempo and the precedent for the year that followed, where events following October 7th were similarly very difficult to have imagined or anticipated without October 7th. I look back at things I wrote in, say, late October and November, assuming just kind of pro forma that there was going to be a ceasefire within the next weeks or months, right? There was no universe I had entertained where there would still be an ongoing war in Israel-Gaza 1 year later. I hadn't even contemplated that, to be very honest, which is a failure of imagination on my part. And then equally, the expansion of the war to southern Lebanon and now direct confrontation between Israel and Iran. Each one of those things became more probable and then unveiled themselves over time. But on October 7th, they were impossible to imagine. And it's worth reflecting for all of us, Israelis, Palestinians, but the international community, on our own failures that have resulted in this and what we should do better in order to end this current dynamic.
John, the BBC's Jeremy Bowen interviewed Khalil al-Haya, and he speaks to what you're saying. I'm going to play the clip for you. Jeremy asked him, why did Hamas do the attack on October 7th? This was the exchange.
Let us go back to the 7th of October last year. Why did Hamas attack Israel?
We have to sound an alarm to the world to tell them that we are a people with a cause and demands. It was a blow to Israel, the Zionists' enemy, and a wake-up call to the international community. We had to do something that would tell the world that there is a people who have been under occupation for decades.
So to your point, the underlying issue is the unresolved two-state solution. Is that a viable, from a Palestinian point of view, a viable reason?
Sorry, there's no justification. I want to be super clear, and this is where myself and Hamas depart very, very early on in any kind of dynamic. Nothing justifies the violence of October 7th. The most just cause on earth does not justify the murder and kidnapping of civilians. And I think, you know, it's also ironic because Hamas itself, its support for a two-state solution is at best ambiguous, I would say. But the underlying kind of continued conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, that is why we are where we are, which doesn't place culpability on one side and not the other. It's a failure of a dynamic between both peoples over a past century to resolve a conflict that is resolvable. That's one of the most frustrating things about this. There has probably been no solution to any conflict in human history as deeply researched as the two-state solution that you reference. It's never been a lack of a concept or a formula. What there has been a lack at different times in different parts of the triangle, right? The Israelis, the Palestinians, and the international community. What we've lacked is the right sort of conditions in each of those three corners in order to push us towards real conflict resolution. And so, you know, I really wish that we had seen the world reprioritize Israel-Palestine during a period of relative calm, because I think you would have been dealing with much more rational politics than we have right now. But, you know, knowing what we know about human nature, unfortunately, that tends not to be how things work. And we have seen crises very often in the Middle East precipitate big political and diplomatic changes. So I think the only, you know, we're talking on the anniversary of October 7th, and nothing is going to justify or make right the incredible losses on that day and in the 12 months since, with, you know, tens of thousands of people dead as a result of what has now taken place. But the one thing that might be a bookend to what we've seen is that it's the last Israeli-Palestinian war, right? That historians of the future look back and see this as being a turning point when enough Israelis and Palestinians looked over the precipice and realized that they didn't want to follow this path of dehumanization and mutual horror and disenfranchisement. And that when the international community finally got serious about an issue that they've been paying lip service to and really, in their own way, dehumanizing Israelis and Palestinians by thinking they were sort of these diplomatic chess pieces on a board rather than millions of human beings whose lives are intertwined, and that there's an obligation the international community owes to them to try and really meaningfully end this conflict that we have had a part in continuing ourselves over the past 100 years.
Yeah, that's kind of leads me into this question of were the U.S. and world powers really genuine in their condemnations, and then in the months that followed, or were they actually complicit in ignoring even international law and world order?
I mean, to expand the lens a little bit, we're not living in the greatest moment for the kind of system of international norms and order, right? They're being infringed at the margins or in the center in many different places around the world. Every single power, in my view, is guilty of some degree of hypocrisy about where they're applied and where they're ignored. And I think it's, you know, taking it out of Israel-Palestine, that's a very dangerous situation for us all to be in. And number one, for the reasons around insecurity and global sort of fragility, but also every one of the biggest problems we face as an international community requires cooperation multilaterally and norms being applied. We just don't live in an era where any individual power is able to remake events around them to their preference, right? It's just it's not the world we inhabit, and I think there needs to be a reflection on what has failed over the last year, about the hypocrisy that many people can see, about the different application of rules and norms, certainly, but also they're all negative things, right? And it's important to be self-critical. What are the positives? Where are the areas where we think there is participation and cooperation that we can deepen? What are the new norms or laws or institutions we can put in place? You know, much like after previous crises, we've seen, you know, the creation of institutions to really fix problems that have become endemic. And on that, I think it really needs to come out of the corridors of power internationally and actually into the homes and lives of ordinary people. Like the UN and international institutions, they feel very remote to Israelis and Palestinians and arguably to most people around the world. What we really need is institutions that speak directly to citizens and civilians and empower and strengthen them and their work. Paradoxically, we've seen the United States, European countries, others issue statements that don't really seem to have any grip or traction on events in Israel-Palestine. But you know what does have grip and traction is movements on the ground. They actually shift the politics. We've seen it over and over again, whether it's hostage families, the families of bereaved Israelis and Palestinians. They have driven prime ministers and presidents to take positions they didn't want to take because of the bottom-up pressure that they apply. And if we empower and radically scale their work, it actually could be a far quicker journey from where we are to somewhere much better than a series of UN resolutions or presidential speeches. And I feel like it's something that we've always missed in Israel-Palestine. It's been a conflict that's been mediated in smoke-filled rooms, whereas actually citizens on the ground have the greatest agency and also skin in the game to be able to shift things much more substantially.
You know, in that regard, and you're not the first person that said to us, this is a turning point in the Middle East. In the last year, can you speak to the people you're talking about, the citizens of the Palestinian territory, the citizens of Israel and of the greater Middle East? Because I still hear, while I hear what you reference, the families of hostages and the people, some people in Gaza who want all of this to end, I still hear both people on both sides saying we have to kill them. That's the only solution. Just in the last couple of weeks in northern Israel, there were people in that population who were in favor of the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah.
Right. And at the same time, I heard a hostage family member just the other night saying Netanyahu's ignoring the will of the people. We don't even care about winning. We just want our people home.
Each society contains multitudes, right? Like, so all those things are true. And I would also say that the kind of the trauma we're seeing right now, it brings out different people in different people, aspects or reactions in different people. But the trauma at this kind of acute level isn't forever. I mean, first of all, we need to get a ceasefire, right? And then I believe we can move into a different phase of this crisis where people can begin to look a little bit further into the horizon. Right now, there is a kind of survival instinct within both societies that's very human and can sometimes result in people acting in angry or destructive ways. But at the same time, we have also seen the work of peace-building organizations and leaders radically expand since October 7th. I mean, we lead a network at OLMEP of over 160 organizations, and well over a quarter of them have radically expanded their work from before October 7th. So you can see it just there. And I'm obviously biased because I spend my time every day with Israelis and Palestinians that want to work together for peace, equality, and justice. But I also see how the proof of concept is there, right? That with more momentum, more resources, more of a diplomatic horizon, right? Feeling as if their efforts on the ground are part of a wider international effort to end the conflict. I really believe we could be at a turning point. And I don't think this is naive optimism. I think that enough people will surely recognize the limited returns of further violence. And I really want to put a cautionary note out to some of the things that we're hearing internationally. There is a lot of kind of almost messianic talk. I think you're getting it from people who are pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli about how violence, about the application of just a bit more violence, a bit more war, can remake the Middle East and arrange all these variables in a way that is more pleasing to you. This is a region that has had more war, more weapons sent into it than any other for the last five decades. If the problem was a deficit of violence, I think we would have known it before now. By contrast, we haven't tried Israeli-Palestinian diplomacy for over a decade, and the last attempt at it was kind of theater. So I think the burden of proof, to be very blunt, is on those who think a war can remake this region, because we have lots of evidence to the contrary. And I think there's also an obligation to try the nonviolent and diplomatic path that is being neglected before one reverts to using war as a catalyst for a change, which, again, across the region, across decades, we have zero evidence that those who have constructed plans like that have resulted at the end of it with what they intended. I can't think of a single instance. Whereas diplomacy delivered peace between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Jordan, the Abraham Accords, whatever you think of them, the Oslo Accords for all of its failures, real serious shifts and gains that resulted in nobody losing their lives and in opening up new diplomatic and political pathways. And for Israel, just in a narrow Israeli perspective, their two quietest borders are with Jordan and Egypt, their two largest neighbors. That was the gain from diplomacy. And, you know, if you look at where the challenge and the tension is across the region, it's places where we have seen decades of conflict and no attempt at diplomacy.
Do you see the parallel between the 67 war and that peace with those two nations and what we're seeing now in this triangle of Israel, Iran, and the proxies?
Yeah, I mean, there's parallels in both directions with the Six-Day War, right? So in a way, it also, you know, it may be re-scrambled events in the Middle East to make over time, and it did take decades, peace between Israel and Egypt and then Jordan possible. But it also kind of cursed Israel with the acquisition of all of this territory, which in my view is one of the prime drivers for their insecurity today. Right. If Israel had not ended up militarily occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip at the end of the Six-Day War, or if it had found a way to be able to return that land in exchange for peace and diplomatic recognition, we'd be in a radically different place right now. And the other thing is, there's a differentiation between violence reordering things and, yes, potentially opening up new opportunities via its dynamism when the violence has already taken place. So, like, we are a year into this war already. It is the most violent war in the Middle East in living memory. Surely that's enough violence for whatever dynamism or disruption is required to be able to open up diplomatic avenues. If you're saying we need to now expand the worst war in recent memory further into the future with more direct confrontation and more insecurity, it's just, it's a very dangerous proposition, particularly when you haven't tried to figure out a diplomatic off-ramp for this moment. You know, and again, I'm putting myself, I guess, in the shoes of Israeli strategists when I'm thinking this way, but violence and war ultimately are political tools. They're ones I don't like very much, but that's usually what they're there to, is to engineer and open up different political and diplomatic opportunities. I'm not hearing a clear articulation of what the political and diplomatic endgame at the very end of all this war is supposed to be. And if it isn't something that's able to address the underlying issues that have resulted in decades of violence, then my worry is that it could be without end, right? That it's simply war in search of security that is itself elusive, because the things that are continuing insecurity for the people of the region are not being addressed.
Mm. All right. And of course, the next occupant of the White House will inherit one of the most perilous crises facing a modern president. John Linden is executive director with the Alliance for Middle East Peace. We are so grateful that you took the time to speak with us. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.
It actually came down our road, and it took out about six or seven big farms. It leveled barns to the ground. Greenhouses were completely twisted and thrown up in the air, gone.
Two back-to-back monster hurricanes in the southeastern United States were a glaring reminder of how climate change is affecting the weather. Here's Ben Clark, research associate in extreme weather and climate change at Imperial College London.
The closeness of these two storms really symbolizes something that could happen in the future and the danger of climate change, which is that you could have multiple events that have been made each more destructive by climate change affecting the same area in quick succession, which is when the impacts start to become kind of really catastrophic.
For a deeper look into what's happening with these storms, we're joined by Michael Winner, a senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
Rapid intensification is what generally happens when a storm becomes a category 5 or category 4 even, where all of a sudden the pressure drops by a lot. The formal definition is 35 millibars in 24 hours. This storm dropped by a lot more than that. So very intense rapid intensification. That meant that this storm was going to be intense and damaging and probably deadly. One of the things that we do know about rapid intensification is it requires very warm water underneath. The warm water, the hot water in the Gulf of Mexico in this case, is the source of energy for the storm. And that there are record temperatures occurring across the planet, but especially in the Gulf of Mexico, because of climate change. We have a paper that actually looked at this very issue of rapid intensification due to climate change, and we find that the situations where this phenomena can occur is increased because of climate change, especially near the coast, and so that's of great concern.
I know you took a look specifically at the storm that just preceded this hurricane, Helene, and at one point in time, you applied the calculation to how much rain fell inland in areas that normally don't get that intense a storm, right?
Indeed. And, you know, the hazards from a large tropical cyclone, a large hurricane, are multifold. You know, the wind is what the Saffir-Simpson scale and what you hear about, you know, categories 4 and 5, is what determines that number. But most of the damage from a large storm actually is from flooding. And along the coast, it can be saltwater flooding from the storm surge. And in inland, it's freshwater flooding from the copious amounts of rainfall. And it's that latter damage impact that we have we understand well and we've written about a lot. And that's what we studied for Hurricane Helene.
What can you say about what we're seeing now in comparison to past hurricanes that you've looked at?
Well, there are two things that I can say with high confidence. One is that the risk of a major hurricane has been increased because of climate change. The second is that, especially for the large hurricanes, the amount of rainfall that falls has been increased dramatically because of climate change. And we understand that pretty well. We know from 19th century steam engine technology that the fully saturated air, which is the situation during a big storm, can the moisture that's in that fully saturated air increases at about 7% per degree centigrade warming. But what we find in these studies is that the rainfall increases at a much greater rate, usually 2 or 3 or even higher than that, times that 7% per degree. You know, so we find results more like 20 or 30% increases in rainfall, which is really substantial. And the reason for that is that not only is there increased available moisture, but there's increased energy because everything is warmer. And that increased energy, available energy, means that the winds are a little bit stronger. And a little bit increase in the winds, in the horizontal winds, increases the vertical motion, the updraft, they call it, in the storm. And so the storm is more violent, and this more violent storm is more efficient at raining out this available moisture. So you sort of have a whammy. You've got more moisture and increased efficiency. And so it leads to these rather large rainfall amounts.
Globally, right, if you apply this same foundational principle around the world, we're going to see these kind of weather events, no matter where you are, become worse and worse because we're still warming the planet, no?
Well, indeed, and we're already seeing that. We have another paper, Jim Costin, who's a former NOAA scientist, and myself, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, proposing a hypothetical Category 6 extension of the Saffir-Simpson scale. And Hurricane Milton did not quite reach our threshold of 192 miles an hour, although it came close. But there have been 5 storms in the last decade that have reached that threshold, and none before that in the historical record.
That is frightening.
We thought so.
Michael, thanks so much for the time and the insight.
Thank you very much.
Michael Winner, a senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, The Issue, also Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.